United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Content with nothing. What are its lessons? Is it possible? What can we do with it in our own lives? Hello, I'm Jerry Christensen, and this is the Seminary Explores. My guest today is Dylan Miller, who is currently a reporter with the Gettysburg Times in Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. And reporter is probably a good word for it, but he's a feature writer as well. At any rate, by the time this is heard, he's going to be the development director at a Buddhist monastery and near Wappinger Falls in New York. How did you come to withdraw into the woods around Juniata College and spend a year studying your own self and a lifestyle that hardly any of us ever develop, and did this as a very young man? How did you come to that point?
Well, I came to that point because I grew up reading a lot of Thoreau, and I read My Side of the Mountain. I lived near woods. I was always spending time there, and I started to find that the more time that I spent in the woods, the more comfortable I became, and it got to the point where I was sleeping outside more, and by the time I got to college, I joined a survivalist club where you build debris huts and you basically sleep in them in November with just a blanket. It's very cold and kind of earth-shattering at the outset, but even that you can get used to. And so I really started to explore, how simple can you get, and becoming comfortable with that. Within that setting, is actually very powerful. So I sort of gave up the dorm life, I would say junior year, and slept in a hammock when it was warm, and slept in a cave whenever it was cold, and went to class back and forth. And then finally, my senior year, I decided to build the hut that is about 17 square feet. It had a bed and a writing desk, windows, wood floors, insulation, everything.
All built by you.
All built by me.
And you're not living, completely free of the world. You had to go down for groceries. You had to go to class. Probably nothing else. A little bit of heating element in the... And you stayed there despite the fact that this was in 2015, and it was one of the coldest winters we've had in years. Was there at any time that you at least had to... withdraw from the hut altogether and stay somewhere else?
It was interesting because I'm an English major, so I was lucky enough to be able to read books for a lot of my assignments. So I didn't need the internet quite as much, but as any college student, I certainly did need the internet. So there were times when I had to resort to the college lifestyle of, sitting under fluorescent lights for a couple of many hours until well into the night. Whereas whenever I was in the woods reading, it would get dark, and I would go to bed at like 8:30. Mm-hmm. But then down on campus, I would stay up past 12 sometimes, just trying to get all the work done. So there were times when I kind of had to just stay on campus because of the work. Mm-hmm. And then whenever it got really cold, I had to stay on campus a few times because I had an agreement with the college that anything under 0 degrees, I wouldn't sleep in the woods.
In which case, you did not sleep inside a house?
Whenever
on a
I was...
porch or something to ensure you did not acclimatize to...
Yes, at that point, I had tried this years before. I just wanted to see how long I could keep shorts on without, resorting to pants to keep me warm. And it's actually pretty amazing how quickly your body can become acclimated to different conditions. And I soon found that I, didn't really need to put on a jacket every time like I thought. And I became quite used to the cold and was sleeping in about 30 or 40 degrees routinely by the time October and November came around. So whenever I was on campus, I would sleep on my friend's porch instead of inside because at that point it was too hot inside.
It was already becoming apparent that you were accustomed to the woods. You carried water in and groceries, carried trash out, often did your cooking in the woods?
Mm-hmm.
On an open fire, did you build a stove? And you didn't have a stove inside this hut. You probably had a small heating element of some kind, an oil lamp or a...
I had a small propane
mm-hmm.
heater. And I had a small, tiny little propane stove for whenever it was too rainy mm-hmm. outside to build a fire to cook.
Okay.
Yep.
Right.
But I did bring everything up and back, and, you know, at the outset, I kind of had this romantic idea, as I'm sure most young people, and I've met several older people as well, kind of have this romantic idea of living in the woods, especially after reading books like Walden from Thoreau or reading Emerson, things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But to do that and then go to college actually made more work for me because nobody else had to carry water for 30 minutes up a hill or haul propane in their trash and cook their own food and everything. So I had to do all of this in addition to the 18 credits that I was using. So my romantic hopes were kind of immediately dashed. But that's okay. That's... certainly part of the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you were living with one foot in two worlds at the same time, and that's part of the learning that we'll talk about here mm-hmm. in just a minute. You've implied, let me ask outright, your faculty not only approved of this, but set certain kind of limits because they do have a certain responsibility to you as a student.
Certainly. One of the requirements was that I had to keep my cell phone charged, just, you know, for safety reasons. And I had to, like I said before, mm-hmm. stay inside when it got below zero. And I had to have a toilet up there with me. And there was one more thing. I had to tear it down at the end. Mm-hmm. I couldn't leave the structure. So those were the four main requirements that they've asked me to meet. But other than that, it took a lot of convincing to let them, you know, to let me live mm-hmm. out of sight 30 minutes into the woods, but they were very gracious and allowed me to do so.
The end result, besides your own learning, was a paper for your seminar or a senior thesis?
Yes, it was a senior thesis. So I researched a lot of different authors and figures that had done something similar. So the most familiar comes to mind is, of course, Thoreau, but there's been very many who have even taken it farther than him or have followed in his footsteps and tried it out. In all, it seems like there's a widespread theme of wanting to escape to the woods to search for contentment. And so rather than kind of read about that and write a senior thesis, I was an English and philosophy major, rather than write a thesis on that just by studying it in the library, I wanted to live it and experience it for myself.
Do you expect that this paper, which you submitted, and was, I presume, approved since you graduated from Juniata
yeah.
College, with flying colors, I'm sure, would you like to publish this someday? And if so, what's the status of it right now?
Well, the paper itself is... I don't want to say pretty academic in this. It's not
sure.
It's very research based.
Yeah.
It's not so much high minded, but research based.
Yeah.
I am currently writing a book. I have about four chapters done, and the challenge for me is going from this research base to making a little bit more fun to read for the average person because. The difference, I think, is there's lots of books about people who have lived in the woods for a year. But what I kind of touch on is I established a routine in the woods, and many people dream about escaping routine or the mundane, you know, looking for something grander. But whenever you move into the woods, you still have chores, you still have a lot to do, and once it becomes normal, the magic's almost gone. So contentment really depends on your mind. It's not, if you rely on external circumstances like the woods, you're kind of just moving all your problems to another location.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly catches up. So I hope that this is kind of well portrayed, and that's my biggest challenge right now.
The contentment has to come in two ways then, if I hear you correctly. One is in doing those daily chores that are absolutely necessary for your survival, even though they're no longer romanticized after a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
But one has to And I think that's true of Christian monasticism and probably all monastic forms throughout history, mm-hmm. that you have to, whatever your work is, it has to be some kind of work. There has to be a certain contentment in that,
mm-hmm.
Hauling your garbage, cooking your meals. But then the contentment that comes after this kind of contentment, which is quite different, and that is once you've got yourself set up and you're everything's fully charged,
mm-hmm.
then there may be that time for reading or thinking or just turning inside, watching a star, however you may do that, which we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm. Well, the actual project name, Content With Nothing, actually kind of summarizes this very, very cleanly, because it has two meanings. So the first meaning, Content With Nothing, means, you know, nothing can really make us content. And we can see that just because people have this idea of happiness, and everyone wants happiness, but we're always looking to external conditions to satisfy that. But external conditions are constantly changing, so our mental state is constantly changing within that too. And we look for more ways to find contentment, but if we keep looking in external circumstances, we just kind of keep gathering things into our lap, and
mm-hmm.
And it can be very stressful, and when you don't know how to manage your stress, it can lead to all sorts of problems, like eating problems, heart disease, high blood pressure. A lot of it stems from this inability to be content. So that's the problem. The solution, meaning content with nothing, means that ideally we don't need anything to be content. You know, we sort of maintain an inner state of peace and allow external circumstances to do what they do, which is always change and fluctuate. But we don't sort of fluctuate with them. And I think whenever you see a lot of monastic disciplines or hermits or solitude, that's part of the goal.
It seems to me then that you're one. Let me suggest to you though, one of your main learnings will be that whether or not we build a hut in the woods,
mm-hmm.
real contentment will come through simplicity, but mm-hmm. most of all, a certain kind of inner core of satisfaction with self,
mm-hmm.
and with who we are, with being itself. You know, all those big, but it really means something about myself,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the things I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Jerry, I think you made a good point there. I don't want people to think that you have to move into the woods
right.
to be content.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that some of the works that are out there, maybe not intentionally, but they do kind of portray that to a point. And so whenever people have families and they can't, you know, escape into the woods, it kind of sets them up for unhappiness. But
mm-hmm.
I went to the woods because I was blessed enough to have the opportunity to do so, and it was just conducive for me. I like being in the woods. There's very little distractions, so it was conducive for me. But there's no reason why you couldn't do this kind of work anywhere else.
We're talking to Dylan Miller, who is currently a reporter, a feature writer and reporter for the Gettysburg Times, and will soon be the development director at a Buddhist monastery. Oh, gosh, we've got another program coming here. in near Wappinger Falls in New York. And our title is Content With Nothing. That was the title of his senior paper, based on a year living in the woods near Juniata College. And I presume, I hope, will be the title of the book, which we hope will result from this after a further period of refinement and contemplation. Mm-hmm. We've spent the whole first half of this program talking about what it was. But the fun part, and I would have been tempted to start with this, but the fun part was that this year in isolation turned into a total interesting, fascinating irony when somehow, somewhere, the Associated Press got wind of the story and then tell us what happened.
Well, once they got a hold of it, it must have been a slow news week everywhere, because it really showed up everywhere. I expected it to be in the local newspaper, but after the AP guy came and he toured the hut and followed me around for part of the day and filmed and interviewed me and everything, after that was released, it kind of blew up. It really did. I started getting requests from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, USA Today interviewed me, MTV.
MTV.
The video segment that the AP guy took showed up on Good Morning America. I got interviewed from a Greek publisher in broken English. and I was in the London Times and the New York Times. This was really overwhelming for me, by the way, because at the beginning of the project, I was really enjoying my anonymity. There was something about, you know, mingling with everybody else, my friends, my fellow students on campus, and living a normal student life, but then retreating into the hut and nobody knew who I was.
Nobody said, "Hey, Dylan, let's go out to your place for a party."
Yeah, that was great.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Nobody knew. I loved that. And that slowly started to disappear, but it was completely destroyed after the AP released that, and people started actually seeking me out. And I was trying to finish my semester with 18 credits, my last, you know, I was trying to graduate, and it was a lot at once.
When you walked around campus, you could feel the eyes on your back and people pointing and whispering. And
it became very tempting to just stay in the woods at that point.
and did some of the co-eds are asking for your phone number and so on. Well, we will go into that in the program. There's a tremendous irony about that, but it's been true of people who made that kind of lifestyle choices. I mean, all the way back to history, the funniest one and the most notorious is Simeon Stylites, the guy that went up on a lived on the top of a pole, you know, and of course became so famous that pilgrimages were made to the place. So you can't over-exaggerate the irony. And often these same pilgrims then move further and further away from society. Mm-hmm. One thinks a little bit of Thomas Merton that way. And then, of course, there was a famous movie and book a few years ago where the young man did move so far away that he finally couldn't find his way back. Rather tragic. Mm-hmm. But you were not, that was not your point. It was not to, you weren't an athlete for whatever religion was. You weren't trying to outdo people. You were trying to find what does constitute contentment.
Yes.
What were your main lessons about that in life? Are you going to do it again? Will you adopt this as a lifestyle? What do you think was the main thing that led to the contentment that you at least did find during that period?
Well, it was strange because along that same line, whenever I was young, I was kind of inspired by those who just sort of I don't want to say ran away, but went on a journey, went on a voyage, so to speak. Went off into the wilderness, things like that. You know, every day is different, right? But soon, like, the more you start practicing contentment, practicing patience, you start to see that you don't have to go anywhere for things to change. Things will change whether you want them to or not. And, you know, by maintaining sort of an internal solidarity, it gives you a vantage point from which to watch and observe. And the more you really start to slough off things that you might think are necessary, and if you really want to keep pushing it and pushing it, the more appreciation you'll get for what folks call the smaller things.
And are really the bigger things.
The bigger things. Yeah. And you can start to see how things are connected. So really, if you want to think of contentment as a foundation for, you know, whatever contemplations you want to take part in, it helps you keep your focus, and it helps to, you know, give you a calm vantage point, and that can carry on to anything else in your life, especially your work life. You know, the only reason we suffer doing dishes is because we're constantly thinking about what else we could be doing other than doing dishes. What if you just do the dishes and not think about it? You know, the suffering associated with that kind of goes away. And it's impressive how far you can take that and how many different things you can apply it to. So certainly, I'm going to constantly test myself. And I wouldn't tell anybody else to do that, but if they want to you know, engage in that as well. You know, they don't have to live in the woods. They can certainly just do it with whatever is in their life at that moment.
Yeah. In our last couple of minutes, I've avoided so far because you have not mentioned, and that's, you're perfect right, Mm-hmm. But for the last couple minutes of the program, let's talk about where you're going now. It's a Buddhist monastery. We have not mentioned religion. You have not necessarily adopted a religious lifestyle. You're not doing this like Christian monasticism or Buddhist or Sufi Muslim monasticism. You've been doing it on your own. But you're going to be. Will you be practicing the Buddhist form of when you are actually working for this Buddhist monastery in New York?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, you know, before we can really thoroughly talk about Buddhism, and we certainly can't talk about Buddhism in 2 minutes, but, you know, a lot of it has to do with the tradition from which it came. So if you look at Tibet, in the West we were developing sciences around external phenomena, and on the contrary, in Tibet, if you've seen Tibet, there's really not much going on externally. It's quite a lot of mountain and grassland. The bulk of their work was actually, with the mind. I mean, we talk about external circumstances. The weather there is horrid. So they had to find some way to sort of find contentment with that. And they took it quite extreme. And the standard for the monks there, 1 in 4 citizens became monks. And the standard education is 18 years. And that's I think that's close to a master's here. And, you know, Inuits have about 100 words for snow. We have one. And so their language is very, very rich in regards to meditation, whereas we only have one word, meditation. So some of those folks have come over here to New York and settled, and they're teaching different techniques to find this contentment. And so I'm going up, and I've been learning from them for a little bit now, and I'll get the opportunity to live with them. So I would say that I would still remain sectarian, but I would certainly love to learn more about their culture and what they've been doing for the past 1,200 years.
So after Content with Nothing, there may be a book on the Buddhist way of life for the Western world. You might you might think ahead a bit. We'll be looking for Content with Nothing, a book that is now in process, with our guest today, Dylan Miller, who is currently a Gettysburg Times feature writer and will soon be the development director at a Buddhist monastery in New York. We've been talking about Content with Nothing, the lessons learned, the irony of living in the world and still trying to be content with nothing. And we've learned a great deal about what it means to be self-sufficient. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.